correlates of interspecies perspective taking in the postmortem Atlantic salmon, an argument for multiple comparisons correction. It takes a second to unwrap the jargony title, but when you do, the poster announces pretty clearly the unusual nature of its results. A dead fish, scanned in an fMRI device, was shown a series of photographs of human beings and was found to have a surprisingly strong ability to correctly assess the emotions the people in the pictures displayed. That would be impressive enough for a dead person or a live fish. For a dead fish, it's Nobel Prize material. But the paper, of course, is a deadpan gag, and a well-executed one. I especially like the methods section, which starts, "One mature Atlantic salmon, Salmo salar, participated in the fMRI study. The salmon was approximately 18 inches long, weighed 3.8 pounds, and was not alive at the time of scanning. Foam padding was placed within the head coil as a method of limiting salmon movement during the scan, but proved to be largely unnecessary as subject motion was exceptionally low." This joke, like all jokes, is a veiled attack. In this case, an attack on sloppy methodology among those neuroimaging researchers who make the mistake of ignoring the fundamental truth that improbable things happen a lot. Neuroscientists divvy up their fMRI scans into tens of thousands of small pieces called voxels, each corresponding to a small region of the brain. When you scan a brain, even a cold dead fish brain, there's a certain amount of random noise coming through on each voxel. It's pretty unlikely that the noise will happen to spike exactly at the moment that you show the fish a snapshot of a person in emotional extremity. But the nervous system is a big place, with tens of thousands of voxels to choose from. The odds that one of those voxels provides data matching up well with the photos is pretty good. That's exactly what Bennett and his collaborators found. In fact, they located two groups of voxels that did an excellent job empathizing with human emotion, one in the salmon's medial brain cavity and the other in the upper spinal column. The point of Bennett's paper is to warn that the standard methods of assessing results, the way we draw our thresholds between a real phenomenon and random static, come under dangerous pressure in this era of massive datasets effortlessly obtained. We need to think very carefully about whether our standards for evidence are strict enough if the empathetic salmon makes the cut. The more chances you give yourself to be surprised, the higher your threshold for surprise it better be. If a random internet stranger who eliminated all North American grains from his food intake reports that he dropped 15 pounds and his eczema went away, you shouldn't take that as powerful evidence in favor of the maize-free plan. Somebody's selling a book about that plan, and thousands of people bought that book and tried it, and the odds are very good that, by chance alone, one among them will experience some weight loss and clear skin the next week, and that's the guy who's going to log in as Say Goodbye to Corn 452 and post his excited testimonial, while the people for whom the diet failed stay silent. The really surprising result of Bennett's paper isn't that one or two voxels in a dead fish passed a statistical test. It's that a substantial proportion of the neuroimaging articles he surveyed didn't use statistical safeguards known as multiple comparisons correction that take into account the ubiquity of the improbable. Without those corrections, scientists are at serious risk of running the Baltimore stockbroker con not only on their colleagues, but on themselves. Getting excited about the fish voxels that matched the photos and ignoring the rest is as potentially dangerous as getting excited about the successful series of stock newsletters while ignoring the many more additions that blew their calls and went in the trash. Reverse engineering, or why algebra is hard. There are two moments in the course of education where a lot of kids fall off the math train. The first comes in the elementary grades when fractions are introduced. Until that moment, a number is a natural number, one of the figures 0, 1, 2, 3, and so on. It is the answer to a question of the form, how many? To go from this notion, so primitive that many animals are said to understand it, to the radically broader idea that a number can mean what portion of, is a drastic philosophical shift. God made the natural numbers, the 19th century algebraist Leopold Kronecker famously said, and all the rest is the work of man. The second dangerous twist in the track is algebra. Why is it so hard? because until algebra shows up, you're doing numerical computations in a straightforwardly algorithmic way. You dump some numbers into the addition box, or the multiplication box, or even, in traditionally minded schools, the long division box. You turn the crank, and you report what comes out the other side. Algebra is different. It's computation backward. When you're asked to solve x plus 8 equals 15, you know what came out of the addition box, namely 15, and you're being asked to reverse engineer what, along with the 8, went in. In this case, as your 7th grade math teacher no doubt once told you, you can flip things over to get things right side around again. X equals 15 minus 8, at which point, you can just toss 15 and 8 in the subtraction box, making sure now to keep track of which one you toss first, and find that X must be 7. But it's not always so easy. You might need to solve a quadratic equation, like x squared minus x equals 1. Really? I hear you cry. Might you? Other than that your teacher asked you to, why would you? Well, think back to that missile from chapter 2, still traveling furiously toward you. Maybe you know that the missile launched from 100 meters above ground level with upward velocity of 200 meters per second. If there was no such thing as gravity, the missile would just keep on rising along a straight line in accordance with Newton's laws, getting 200 meters higher each second, and its height after x seconds would be described by the linear function height equals 100 plus 200x. But there is such a thing as gravity, which bends the arc and forces the missile to curve back toward Earth. It turns out that the effect of gravity is described by adding a quadratic term, height equals 100 plus 200x minus 5x squared, where the quadratic term is negative just because gravity pushes missiles down, not up. There are a lot of questions you might ask about a missile heading toward you, but one of particularly great import is, when will it land? To answer this is just to answer the question, when will the height of the missile be zero? That is, for what value of x is it the case that 100 plus 200x minus 5x squared equals zero? It's by no means clear how you're supposed to flip this equation around and solve for x. But maybe you don't have to. Trial and error is a very powerful weapon. If you plug in x equals 10 into the above formula to see how high the missile is after 10 seconds, you get 1600 meters. Plug in x equals 20 and you get 2100 meters, so it looks like the missile may still be rising. When x equals 30, you get 1600 again, promising we must be past the peak. At x equals 40, the missile is once again just 100 meters above the ground. We could walk forward 10 more seconds, but when we're so close to impact already, that's surely overdoing it. If you plug in x equals 41, you get negative 105 meters, which doesn't mean you're predicting the missile has actually begun burrowing under the Earth's surface, but rather that impact has already happened so that your nice clean model of the missile's motion is, as we say in ballistics, no longer operative. So if 41 seconds is too long, what about 40 and a half? That gives negative 1.25 meters, just a little bit below zero. Turn back the clock a little to 40.4, and you get 19.2 meters, so impact hasn't happened yet. 40.49, very close, just 0.8 meters above the ground. You can see that by playing the trial and error game, carefully turning the time knob back and forth, you can approximate the time of impact as closely as you like. But have we solved the equation? You're probably hesitant to say you have. After all, even if you keep fine-tuning your guesses until you get the time of impact pinned down to 40.49390153.19, etc., etc., seconds after launch, you don't know the answer, but just an approximation of the answer. In practice, though, it doesn't help you to time the impact to the millionth of a second, does it? Probably just saying about 40 seconds is enough. Try to generate an answer any more precise than that, and you're wasting your time, and you'll probably be wrong, besides. Because our very simple model of the missile's progress fails to take into account many other factors, like air resistance, the variation in air resistance coming from weather, the spin of the missile itself, and so on. These effects may be small, but they're surely big enough to keep you from knowing down to the microsecond when the projectile will show up for its appointment with the ground. If you want a satisfyingly exact solution, never fear, The quadratic formula is here to help. You may well have memorized this formula once in your life, but unless you have an unusually gifted memory or you are 12, you don't have it in mind just at the moment. So here it is. If x is a solution to c plus bx plus ax squared equals 0, where a, b, and c are any numbers whatsoever, then x equals negative 1 over 2a times b plus or minus the square root of b squared minus 4ac. In the case of the missile, c equals 100, b equals 200, and a equals negative 5. So what the quadratic formula has to say about x is that x equals 1/10 times 200 plus or minus the square root of 200 squared plus 4 times 5 times 100. Most of the symbols in there are things you could type in your calculator, but there's one funny outlier, the plus or minus sign. It looks like a plus sign and a minus sign that love each other very much, and this isn't so far off. It indicates that, although we started our mathematical sentence, all confidence, with x equals, we end up in a state of ambivalence. The plus or minus sign, something like a blank Scrabble tile, can be read as either a plus or a minus, as we choose. Each choice we make produces a value of x that makes the equation 100 plus 200x minus 5x squared equals 0 hold. There is no single solution to this equation. There are two. That there are two values of x which satisfy the equation can be made apparent to the eye even if you long ago forgot the quadratic formula. You can draw a graph of the equation y equals 100 plus 200x minus 5x squared and get a nice upside-down parabola. The horizontal line is the x-axis, those points on the plane whose y-coordinate is 0. When the curve y equals 100 plus 200x minus 5x squared meets the x-axis, it must be the case both that y is 100 plus 200x minus 5x squared and that y is 0. So, 100 plus 200x minus 5x squared equals 0, precisely the equation we were trying to solve, now given geometric form as a question about the intersection between a curve and a horizontal line. And geometric intuition demands that if such a parabola noses its way above the x-axis at all, it must strike the x-axis in exactly two places, no more, no fewer. In other words, there are two values of x such that 100 plus 200x minus 5x squared equals 0. So what are these two values? If we choose to read the plus or minus sign as plus, we get x equals 20 plus twice the square root of 105, which is about 40.493, the same answer we came up with by trial and error. But if we choose minus, we get x equals 20 minus twice the square root of 105, which is about negative 0.493. As an answer to our original question, this is somewhat nonsensical. The answer to when is that missile going to hit me can't be half a second ago. Yet this negative value of x is a perfectly good solution to the equation, and when math tells us something, we should at least try to listen. What does the negative number mean? Here's one way to understand it. We said the missile was launched from 100 meters off the ground at a velocity of 200 meters per second. But all we really used was that, at time zero, the missile was traveling upward at that velocity from that position. What if that wasn't actually the launch? Maybe the launch took place not at time zero from 100 meters up, but at some earlier time directly from the ground. What time? The computation tells us there are exactly two times when the missile is at ground level. One time is 0.493 seconds ago. That's when the missile was launched. The other time is 40.493 seconds from now. That's when the missile lands. Perhaps it doesn't seem so troubling, especially if you're used to the quadratic formula, to get two answers to the same question. But when you're 12, it represents a real philosophical shift. You've spent 6 long years in grade school figuring out what the answer is, and now, suddenly, there's no such thing. And those are just quadratic equations. What if you have to solve x cubed plus 2x squared minus 11x equals 12? This is a cubic equation, which is to say it involves x raised to the third power. Fortunately, there is a cubic formula that allows you to figure out by a direct computation what values of x could have gone in the box to make 12 fall out when you turn the crank. But you didn't learn the cubic formula in school, and the reason you didn't learn it in school is that it's kind of a mess and wasn't worked out until the late Renaissance, when itinerant algebraists roamed across Italy, engaging each other in fierce public equation-solving battles with money and status on the line. The few people who knew the cubic formula kept it to themselves or wrote it down in cryptic rhymed verse. Long story, the point is, reverse engineering is hard. The problem of inference, which is what the Bible coders were wrestling with, is hard because it's exactly this kind of problem. When we are scientists, or Torah scholars, or toddlers gaping at the clouds, we are presented with observations and asked to build theories. What went into the box to produce the world that we see? Inference is a hard thing, maybe the hardest thing. From the shape of the clouds and the way that they move, we struggle to go backward to solve for X, the system that made them. Defeating the null. We've been circling around the fundamental question: how surprised should I be by what I see in the world? This is a book about math, and you must suspect that there's a numerical way to get at this. There is, but it is fraught with danger. We need to talk about p-values. But first, we need to talk about improbability, about which we've been unacceptably vague so far. There's a reason for that. There are parts of math, like geometry and arithmetic, that we teach to children and that children, to some extent, teach themselves. Those are the parts that are closest to our native intuition. We are born almost knowing how to count and how to categorize objects by their location and shape, and the formal mathematical renditions of these concepts are not so different from the ones we start with. Probability is different. We certainly have built-in intuition for thinking about uncertain things, but it's much harder to articulate. There's a reason that the mathematical theory of probability came so late in mathematical history and appears so late in the math curriculum, when it appears at all. When you try to think carefully about what probability means, you get a little woozy. When we say the probability that a flipped coin will land heads is 1 out of 2, we're invoking the law of large numbers from chapter 4, which says that if you flip the coin many, many times, the proportion of heads will almost inevitably approach 1/2, as if constrained by a narrowing channel. This is what's called the frequentist view of probability. But what can we mean when we say the probability that it will rain tomorrow is 20%? Tomorrow only happens once. It's not an experiment we can repeat like a coin flip again and again. With some effort, we can shoehorn the weather into the frequentist model. Maybe we mean that among some large population of days with conditions similar to this one, the following day was rainy 20% of the time. But then you're stuck when asked, what's the probability that the human race will go extinct in the next 1,000 years? This is, almost by definition, an experiment you can't repeat. We use probability even to talk about events that cannot possibly be thought of as subject to chance. What's the probability that consuming olive oil prevents cancer? What's the probability that Shakespeare was the author of Shakespeare's plays? What's the probability that God wrote the Bible and cooked up the earth? It's hard to license talking about these things in the same language we use to assess the outcomes of coin flips and dice rolls. And yet, we find ourselves able to say of questions like this, it seems improbable, or it seems likely. Once we've done so, how can we resist the temptation to ask, how likely? It's one thing to ask, another to answer. I can think of no experiment that directly assesses the likelihood that the man upstairs actually is upstairs, or is a man for that matter. So we have to do the next best thing, or at least what traditional statistical practice holds to be the next best thing. As we'll see, there's controversy on this point. We said it was improbable that the names of medieval rabbis are hidden in the letters of the Torah. But is it? Many religious Jews start from the view that everything there is to know is contained, somehow or other, in the Torah's words. If that's the case, the presence of the rabbis' names and birthdays there is not improbable at all. Indeed, it's almost required. You can tell a similar story about the North Carolina lottery. It sounds improbable that an identical set of winning numbers would come up twice in a single week. And that's true if you agree with the hypothesis that the numbers are drawn from the cage completely at random. But maybe you don't. Maybe you think the randomization system is malfunctioning and the numbers 4, 21, 23, 34, 39 are more likely to come up than others. Or maybe you think a corrupt lottery official is picking the numbers to match his own favorite ticket. Under either of these hypotheses, the amazing coincidence is not improbable at all. Improbability, as described here, is a relative notion, not an absolute one. When we say an outcome is improbable, we are always saying, explicitly or not, that it is improbable under some set of hypotheses we've made about the underlying mechanisms of the world. Many scientific questions can be boiled down to a simple yes or no. Is something going on or not? Does a new drug make a dent in the illness it proposes to cure, or does it do nothing? Does a psychological intervention make you happier, peppier, sexier, or does it do nothing at all? The does-nothing scenario is called the null hypothesis. That is, the null hypothesis is the hypothesis that the intervention you're studying has no effect. If you are the researcher who developed the new drug, the null hypothesis is the thing that keeps you up at night. Unless you can rule it out, you don't know whether you're on the trail of a medical breakthrough or just barking up the wrong metabolic pathway. So how do you rule it out? The standard framework, called the null hypothesis significance test, was developed in its most commonly used form by R.A. Fisher, the founder of the modern practice of statistics in the early 20th century. It goes like this. First, you have to run an experiment. You might start with 100 subjects, then randomly select half to receive your proposed wonder drug, while the other half gets a placebo. Your hope, obviously, is that the patients on the drug will be less likely to die than the ones getting the sugar pill. From here, the protocol might seem simple. If you observe fewer deaths among the drug patients than the placebo patients, declare victory and file a marketing application with the FDA. But that's wrong. It's not enough that the data be consistent with your theory. They have to be inconsistent with the negation of your theory, the dreaded null hypothesis. I may assert that I possess telekinetic abilities so powerful that I can drag the sun out from beneath the horizon. If you want proof, just go outside at about 5 in the morning and see the results of my work. But this kind of evidence is no evidence at all, because under the null hypothesis that I lack psychic gifts, the sun would come up just the same. Interpreting the result of a clinical trial requires similar care. Let's make this numerical. Suppose we're in null hypothesis land, where the chance of death is exactly the same, say 10%, for the 50 patients who got your drug and the 50 who got the placebo. But that doesn't mean that 5 of the drug patients die and 5 of the placebo patients die. In fact, the chance that exactly 5 of the drug patients die is about 18.5%. Not very likely, just as it's not very likely that a long series of coin tosses would yield precisely as many heads as tails. In the same way, it's not very likely that exactly the same number of drug patients and placebo patients expire during the course of the trial. I computed there's a 13.3% chance equally many drug and placebo patients die, 43.3% chance that fewer placebo patients than drug patients die, and 43.3% chance that fewer drug patients than placebo patients die. Seeing better results among the drug patients than the placebo patients says very little, since this isn't at all unlikely, even under the null hypothesis that your drug doesn't work. But things are different if the drug patients do a lot better. Suppose 5 of the placebo patients die during the trial, but none of the drug patients do. If the null hypothesis is right, both classes of patients should have a 90% chance of survival. But in that case, it's highly unlikely that all 50 of the drug patients would survive. The first of the drug patients has a 90% chance. Now, the chance that not only the first, but also the second patient survives is 90% of that 90%, or 81%. And if you want the third patient to survive as well, the chance of that happening is only 90% of that 81%, or 72.9%. Each new patient whose survival you stipulate shaves a little off the chances, and by the end of the process, where you're asking about the probability that all 50 will survive, the slice of probability that remains is pretty slim. It's 0.9 multiplied by itself 50 times, which is just 0.00515. In other words, under the null hypothesis, there's only one chance in 200 of getting results this good. That's much more compelling. If I claim I can make the sun come up with my mind, and it does, you shouldn't be impressed by my powers. But if I claim I can make the sun not come up, and it doesn't, then I've demonstrated an outcome very unlikely under the null hypothesis, and you'd best take notice. So here's the procedure for ruling out the null hypothesis in executive bullet point form. 1. Run an experiment. 2. Suppose the null hypothesis is true and let P be the probability, under that hypothesis, of getting results as extreme as those observed. 3. The number P is called the p-value. If it is very small, rejoice. You get to say your results are statistically significant. If it is large, concede that the null hypothesis has not been ruled out. How small is very small? There's no principled way to choose a sharp dividing line between what is significant and what is not. But there's a tradition, which starts with Fisher himself and is now widely adhered to, of taking p equals 0.05 or 1/20th to be the threshold. Null hypothesis significance testing is popular because it captures our intuitive way of reasoning about uncertainty. Why do we find the Bible codes compelling, at least at first glance? Because codes like the one Wittstrom uncovered are very unlikely under the null hypothesis that the Torah doesn't know the future. The value of P, the likelihood of finding so many equidistant letter sequences so accurate in their demographic profiling of notable rabbis, is very close to zero. Versions of this argument for divine creation predate Fisher's formal development by a great while. The world is so richly structured and so perfectly ordered, how tremendously unlikely it would be for there to be a world like this one under the null hypothesis that there's no primal designer who put the thing together. The first person to have a go at making this argument mathematical was John Arbuthnot, royal physician, satirist, correspondent of Alexander Pope, and part-time mathematician. Arbuthnot studied the records of children born in London between 1629 and 1710 and found there a remarkable regularity. In every single one of those 82 years, more boys were born than girls. What are the odds, Arbuthnot asked, that such a coincidence could arise under the null hypothesis that there was no God and all was random chance? Then, the probability in any given year that London would welcome more boys than girls would be 1/2, and the p-value, the probability of the boys winning 82 times in a row, is 1/2 times itself 82 times, or a little worse than 1 in 4 septillion. In other words, more or less zero. Arbuthnot published his findings in a paper called An Argument for Divine Providence, Taken from the Constant Regularity Observed in the Births of Both Sexes. Arbuthnot's argument was widely praised and repeated by clerical worthies, but other mathematicians quickly pointed to flaws in his reasoning. Chief among them was the unreasonable specificity of his null hypothesis. Arbuthnot's data certainly puts the boot to the hypothesis that the sex of children is determined at random, with each child having an equal chance of being born male or female. But why should the chance be equal? Nicholas Bernoulli proposed a different null hypothesis, that the sex of a child is determined by chance with an 18 out of 35 chance of being a boy and 17 out of 35 of being a girl. Bernoulli's null hypothesis is just as atheistic as Arbuthnot's, and it fits the data perfectly. If you flip a coin 82 times and get 82 heads, you ought to be thinking, something is biased about this coin, not God loves heads. Though Arbuthnot's argument wasn't widely accepted, its spirit carried on. Arbuthnot is intellectual father not only to the Bible coders, but to the creation scientists who argue, even today, that mathematics demands there must be a God on the grounds that a godless world would be highly unlikely to look like the one we have. But significance testing is not restricted to theological apologetics. In some sense, Darwin, the creation scientist's shaggy godless devil, made arguments of substantially the same form on behalf of his own work. He wrote, "It can hardly be supposed that a false theory would explain in so satisfactory a manner as does the theory of natural selection the several large classes of facts above specified. It has recently been objected that this is an unsafe method of arguing, but it is a method used in judging of the common events of life and has often been used by the greatest natural philosophers." In other words, if natural selection were false, think how unlikely it would be to encounter a biological world so thoroughly consistent with its predictions. The contribution of R.A. Fisher was to make significance testing into a formal endeavor, a system by which the significance or not of an experimental result was a matter of objective fact. In the Fisherian form, the null hypothesis significance test has been a standard method for assessing the results of scientific research for nearly a century. A standard textbook calls the method the backbone of psychological research. It's the standard by which we separate experiments into successes and failures. Every time you encounter the results of a medical, psychological, or economic research study, you're very likely reading about something that was vetted by a significance test. But the unease Darwin noted about this unsafe method of arguing has never really receded. For almost as long as the method has been standard, there have been people who branded it a colossal mistake. Back in 1966, the psychologist David Bacon wrote about the crisis of psychology, which in his view was a crisis in statistical theory. He wrote, "The test of significance does not provide the information concerning psychological phenomena characteristically attributed to it. A great deal of mischief has been associated with its use. To say it out loud is, as it were, to assume the role of the child who pointed out that the emperor was really outfitted only in his underwear." And here we stand, almost 50 years later, with the emperor still in office and still cavorting in the same birthday suit, despite the ever larger and more clamorous group of children broadcasting the news about his state of undress. The insignificance of significance. What's wrong with significance? To start with, there's the word itself. Mathematics has a funny relationship with the English language. Mathematical research articles, sometimes to the surprise of outsiders, are not predominantly composed of numerals and symbols. Math is made of words. But the objects we refer to are often entities uncontemplated by the editors at Merriam-Webster. New things require new vocabulary. There are two ways to go. You can cut new words from fresh cloth, as we do when we speak of cohomology, syzygies, monodromy, and so on. This has the effect of making our work look forbidding and unapproachable. More commonly, we adapt existing words for our own purposes based on some perceived resemblance between the mathematical object to be described and a thing in the so-called real world. So a group, to a mathematician, is indeed a group of things, but a very special kind of group, like the group of whole numbers or the group of symmetries of a geometric figure. We mean by it not just an arbitrary collection of things like OPEC or ABBA, but rather a collection of things with the property that any pair of them can be combined into a third, as a pair of numbers can be added or a pair of symmetries can be carried out one after the other. So too, for schemes, bundles, rings, and stacks, mathematical objects which stand in only the most tenuous relation to the ordinary things referred to by those words. Sometimes the language we choose has a pastoral flavor. Modern algebraic geometry, for instance, is largely concerned with fields, sheaves, kernels, and stalks. Other times, it's more aggressive. It is not at all unusual to speak of an operator killing something, or, for a little more of a vroom, annihilating it. I once had an uneasy moment with a colleague in an airport when he made the remark, unexceptional in a mathematical context, that it might be necessary to blow up the plane at one point. So, significance. In common language, it means something like important or meaningful. But the significance test that scientists use doesn't measure importance. When we're testing the effect of a new drug, the null hypothesis is that there is no effect at all. So to reject the null hypothesis is merely to make a judgment that the effect of the drug is not zero. But the effect could still be very small. So small that the drug isn't effective in any sense that an ordinary non-mathematical Anglophone would call significant. The lexical double booking of significance has consequences beyond making scientific papers hard to read. On October 18, 1995, the UK Committee on Safety of Medicines, CSM, issued a Dear Doctor letter to nearly 200,000 doctors and public health workers around Great Britain, with an alarming warning about certain brands of third-generation oral contraceptives. "New evidence has become available," the letter read, "indicating that the chance of a thrombosis occurring in a vein is increased around twofold for some types of pill compared with others." A venous thrombosis is no joke. It means a clot is impeding the flow of the blood through the vein. If the clot breaks free, the bloodstream can carry it all the way to your lung, where, under its new identity as a pulmonary embolism, it can kill you. The Dear Doctor letter was quick to assure readers that oral contraception was safe for most women and no one should stop taking the pill without medical advice. But details like that are easy to lose when the top-line message is pills kill. The AP story that ran October 19th led with, "The government warned Thursday that a new type of birth control pill used by 1.5 million British women may cause blood clots. It considered withdrawing the pills but decided not to, partly because some women cannot tolerate any other kind of pills." The public, understandably, freaked out. One general practitioner found that 12% of pill users among her patients stopped taking their contraceptives as soon as they heard the government report. Presumably, many women switched to other versions of the pill not implicated in thrombosis, but any interruption makes the pill less effective. And less effective birth control means more pregnancies. What, you thought I was going to say there was a wave of abstinence? After several successive years of decline, the conception rate in the United Kingdom jumped several percentage points the next year. There were 26,000 more babies conceived in 1996 in England and Wales than there had been 1 year previously. Since so many of the extra pregnancies were unplanned, that led to a lot more termination, too. 13,600 more abortions than in 1995. This might seem a small price to pay to avoid a blood clot careening through your circulatory system, wreaking potentially lethal havoc. Think about all the women who were spared from death by embolism by the CSM's warning. But how many women exactly is that? We can't know for sure, but one scientist, a supporter of the CSM decision to issue the warning, said the total number of embolism deaths prevented was possibly one. The added risk posed by third-generation birth control pills, while significant in Fisher's statistical sense, was not so significant in the sense of public health. The way the story was framed only magnified the confusion. The CSM reported a risk ratio. Third-generation pills doubled women's risk of thrombosis. That sounds pretty bad, until you remember that thrombosis is really, really rare. Among women of childbearing age using first- and second-generation oral contraceptives, 1 in 7,000 could expect to suffer a thrombosis. Users of the new pill indeed had twice as much risk, 2 in 7,000. But that's still a very small risk because of this certified math fact: twice a tiny number is a tiny number. How good or bad it is to double something depends on how big that something is. Playing Zymergy on a double word score on the Scrabble board is a triumph. Hitting the same square with nose is a waste of a move. Risk ratios are much easier for the brain to grasp than tiny splinters of probability like 1 in 7,000. But risk ratios applied to small probabilities can easily mislead you. A study by sociologists at the City University of New York, or CUNY, found that infants cared for at in-home daycares or by nannies had a fatality rate 7 times that of kids in daycare centers. But before you fire your au pair, consider for a minute that American infants hardly ever die these days, and when they do, it's almost never because a caregiver shook them to death. The annual rate of fatal accidents in home-based care was 1.6 per 100,000 babies, a lot higher, indeed, than the rate of 0.23 per 100,000 in daycare centers. But both numbers are more or less zero. In the CUNY study, only a dozen or so babies a year died in accidents in family daycares, a tiny fraction of the 1,110 U.S. infants who died in accidents overall in 2010, mostly by strangulation in bedclothes, or the 2,063 who died of sudden infant death syndrome. All things being equal, the results of the CUNY study provide a reason to prefer a daycare center to care in a family home, but all other things are usually not equal, and some inequalities matter more than others. What if the scrubbed and city-certified daycare center is twice as far from your house as the slightly questionable family-run in-home daycare? Car accidents killed 79 infants in the U.S. in 2010. If your baby ends up spending 20% more time on the road per year thanks to the longer commute, you may have wiped out whatever safety advantage you gained by choosing the fancier daycare. A significance test is a scientific instrument, and like any other instrument, it has a certain degree of precision. If you make the test more sensitive, By increasing the size of the studied population, for example, you enable yourself to see ever smaller effects. That's the power of the method, but also its danger. The truth is, the null hypothesis, if we take it literally, is probably just about always false. When you drop a powerful drug into a patient's bloodstream, it's hard to believe the intervention has exactly zero effect on the probability that the patient will develop esophageal cancer or thrombosis or bad breath. Every part of the body speaks to every other in a complex feedback loop of influence and control. Everything you do either gives you cancer or prevents it. In principle, if you carry out a powerful enough study, you can find out which it is. But those effects are usually so minuscule that they can be safely ignored. Just because we can detect them doesn't always mean they matter. If only we could go back in time to the dawn of statistical nomenclature and declare that a result passing Fisher's test with a p-value of less than 0.05 was statistically noticeable or statistically detectable instead of statistically significant, that would be truer to the meaning of the method, which merely counsels us about the existence of an effect, but is silent about its size or importance. But it's too late for that. We have the language we have. The myth of the hot hand. We know B.F. Skinner as a psychologist, in many ways the modern psychologist, the man who stared down the Freudians and led a competing psychology, behaviorism, concerned only with what was visible and what could be measured, requiring no hypotheses about unconscious or, for that matter, conscious motivations. For Skinner, a theory of mind just was a theory of behavior, and the interesting projects for psychologists thus did not concern thoughts or feelings at all, but rather the manipulation of behavior by means of reinforcement. Less well known is Skinner's history as a frustrated novelist. Skinner was an English major at Hamilton College and spent much of his time with Percy Saunders, a chemistry professor and aesthete, whose house was a kind of literary salon. Skinner read Ezra Pound and listened to Schubert and wrote adolescently heated poems. At night, he stops, breathless, murmuring to his earthly consort, "Love exhausts me," for the college literary magazine. He did not take a single psychology course. After college, Skinner attended the Breadloaf Writers' Conference, where he wrote what he described as a one-act play about a quack who changed people's personalities with endocrines, and succeeded in pressing several of his short stories on Robert Frost. Frost wrote Skinner a very satisfactory letter praising his stories and counseling, "All that makes a writer is the ability to write strongly and directly from some unaccountable and almost invincible personal prejudice. I take it that everybody has the prejudice and spends some time feeling for it to speak and write from. But most people end, as they begin, by acting out the prejudices of other people." Thus encouraged, Skinner moved into his parents' attic in Scranton in the summer of 1926 and set out to write. But Skinner found it was not so easy to find his own personal prejudice or, having found it, to put it in literary form. His time in Scranton came to nothing. He managed a couple of stories and a sonnet about labor leader John Mitchell, but spent his time mostly building model ships and tuning in to distant signals from Pittsburgh and New York on the radio, then a brand new procrastination device. "A violent reaction against all things literary was setting in," he later wrote of this period. "I had failed as a writer because I had nothing important to say, but I could not accept that explanation. It was literature which must be at fault, or, more bluntly, literature must be demolished." Skinner was a regular reader of the literary magazine The Dial. In its pages, he encountered the philosophical writings of Bertrand Russell, and via Russell was brought to John Watson, the first great advocate of the behaviorist outlook that would soon become almost synonymous with Skinner's name. Watson held that scientists were in the business of observing the results of experiments, and only that. There was no room for hypotheses about consciousness or souls. "No one has ever touched a soul or seen one in a test tube," he famously wrote by way of dismissing the notion. These uncompromising words must have thrilled Skinner as he moved to Harvard as a graduate student in psychology, making ready to banish the vague, unruly self from the scientific study of behavior. Skinner had been much struck by an experience of spontaneous verbal production he'd experienced in his lab, a machine in the background was making a repetitive, rhythmic sound, and Skinner found himself talking along with it, following the beat, silently repeating the phrase, "You'll never get out, you'll never get out, you'll never get out." What seemed like speech, or even in a small way, like poetry, was actually the result of a kind of autonomous verbal process requiring nothing like a conscious author. This provided just the idea Skinner needed to settle his score with literature. What if language, even the language of the great poets, was just another behavior trained by exposure to stimuli and manipulable in the lab? In college, Skinner had written imitations of Shakespeare's sonnets. He retrospectively described this experience in thoroughly behaviorist fashion as the strange excitement of emitting whole lines ready-made, properly scanned and rhymed. Now, as a young psychology professor in Minnesota, he recasts Shakespeare himself as more emitter than writer. This approach was not as crazy then as it seems now. The dominant form of literary criticism at the time, close reading, bore the mark of Watson's philosophy just as Skinner did, displaying a very behaviorist preference for the words on the page over the unobservable intentions of the author. Shakespeare is famous as a master of the alliterative line, in which several words in close succession start with the same sound, "Full fathom five thy father lies." For Skinner, this argument by example was no kind of science. Did Shakespeare alliterate? If he did, then math could prove it so. "Proof that there is a process responsible for alliterative patterning," he wrote, "can be obtained only through a statistical analysis of all the arrangements of initial consonants in a reasonably large sample." And what form of statistical analysis? None other than a form of Fisher's p-value test. Here, the null hypothesis is that Shakespeare paid no heed to the initial sounds of words at all, so that the first letter of one word of poetry has no effect on other words in the same line. The protocol was much like that of a clinical trial, but with one big difference. The biomedical researcher testing a drug hopes with all his heart to see the null hypothesis refuted and the effectiveness of the medicine demonstrated. For Skinner, aiming to knock literary criticism off its plinth, the null hypothesis was the attractive one. Under the null hypothesis, the frequency with which initial sounds appeared multiple times in the same line would be unchanged if the words were put in a sack, shaken up, and laid out again in random order. And this is just what Skinner found in his sample of 100 sonnets. Shakespeare failed the significance test. Skinner writes, "In spite of the seeming richness of alliteration in the sonnets, there is no significant evidence of a process of alliteration in the behavior of the poet to which any serious attention should be given. So far as this aspect of poetry is concerned, Shakespeare might as well have drawn his words out of a hat." Seeming richness, what chutzpah! It captures perfectly the spirit of the psychology that Skinner wanted to create. Where Freud had claimed to see what had previously been hidden, repressed, or obscured, Skinner wanted to do the opposite, to deny the existence of what seemed in plain view. But Skinner was wrong. He hadn't proved that Shakespeare didn't alliterate. A significance test is an instrument like a telescope, and some instruments are more powerful than others. If you look at Mars with a research-grade telescope, you'll see moons. If you look with binoculars, you won't. But the moons are still there. And Shakespeare's alliteration is still there. As documented by literary historians, it was a standard device of the time, known to and consciously deployed by nearly everyone writing in English. What Skinner had proved is that Shakespeare's alliteration did not produce a surplus of repeated sound so great as to show up on his test. But why would it? The use of alliteration in poetry is both positive and negative. In certain places, you alliterate to create an effect, and in other places, you intentionally avoid it, lest you create an effect you don't want. It may be that the overall tendency is to increase the number of alliterative lines, but even if so, the increase should be small. Stuff your sonnets with one or two extra alliterations each, and you become one of the stone-footed poets mocked by Shakespeare's fellow Elizabethan, George Gascoigne, who wrote, "Many writers indulge in repetition of sundry words all beginning with one letter, the which, being modestly used, lendeth good grace to a verse, but they do so hunt a letter to death that they make it crombe, and crombe bis positum mors est." The Latin phrase means, "cabbage served twice is death." Shakespeare's writing is rich in effect, but always restrained. He would never pack in so much cabbage that Skinner's crude test could smell it. A statistical study that's not refined enough to detect the phenomenon of the expected size is called underpowered, the equivalent of looking at the planets with binoculars. Moons or no moons, you get the same result, so you might as well not have bothered. You don't send binoculars to do a telescope's job. The problem of low power is the flip side to the problem of the British birth control scare. A high-powered study, like the birth control trial, may lead you to burst a vein about a small effect that isn't actually important. An underpowered one may lead you to wrongly dismiss a small effect that your method was simply too weak to see. Consider Spike Albrecht, the freshman guard for Michigan's men's basketball team, standing at just 5'11" and a bench player most of the season, wasn't expected to play a big role when the Wolverines faced Louisville in the 2013 NCAA final. But Albrecht made 5 straight shots, 4 of them 3-pointers, in a 10-minute span in the first half, leading Michigan to a 10-point lead over the heavily favored Cardinals. He had what basketball fans call the hot hand, the apparent inability to miss a shot no matter how great the distance or how fierce the defense. Except there's supposed to be no such thing. In 1985, in one of the most famous contemporary papers in cognitive psychology, Thomas Gilovich, Robert Vallone, and Amos Tversky, hereafter GVT, did to basketball fans what B.F. Skinner had done to lovers of the Bard. They obtained records of every shot taken by the 1980-81 Philadelphia 76ers in their 48 home games and analyzed them statistically. If players tended toward hot streaks and cold streaks, you might expect a player to be more likely to hit a shot following a basket than a shot following a miss. And when GVT surveyed NBA fans, they found this theory had broad support. 9 out of 10 fans agreed that a player is more likely to sink a shot when he's just hit 2 or 3 baskets in a row. But nothing of the kind was going on in Philadelphia. Julius Erving, the great Dr. J, was a 52% shooter overall. After 3 straight baskets, a situation that you'd think might indicate Erving was hot, his percentage went down to 48%. And after 3 straight misses, his field goal percentage didn't drop, but rather stayed right at 52%. For other players like Daryl, Chocolate Thunder, Dawkins, the effect was even more extreme. After a hit, his overall 62% shooting percentage dipped to 57%. After a miss, it shot up to 73%, exactly the opposite of the fan predictions. One possible explanation, a missed shot suggests Dawkins was facing effective defenders on the perimeter, inducing him to drive to the basket for one of his trademark backboard-shattering dunks, which he gave names like In-Your-Face Disgrace and Turbo-Sexophonic Delight. Does this mean there's no such thing as the hot hand? Not just yet. The hot hand, after all, isn't generally thought of as a universal tendency for hits to follow hits and misses to follow misses. It's an evanescent thing, a brief possession by a superior basketball being that inhabits a player's body for a short, glorious interval on the court, giving no warning of its arrival or departure. Spike Albrecht is Ray Allen for 10 minutes, mercilessly raining down threes, then he's Spike Albrecht again. Can a statistical test see this? In principle, why not? GVT devised a clever way to check for these short intervals of unstoppability. They broke up each player's season into sequences of 4 shots each. They then counted how many of the sequences were good, 3 or 4 hits, moderate, 2 hits, or bad, 0 or 1 hits, for each of the 9 players in the study. And then, good Fisherians, they considered the results of the null hypothesis, that there's no such thing as the hot hand. There are 16 possible sequences of 4 shots. The first shot can be either a hit or a miss, and for each of these options, there are 2 possibilities for the second shot, giving us 4 options in all for the first 2 shots. Hit, 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 miss, miss, hit, miss, miss. And for each of these 4, there are 2 possibilities for the third shot, giving 8 possible 3-shot sequences. Doubling once more to account for the last shot, we get 16. 5 are good, 5 are bad, and 6 are moderate. For a 50% shooter like Dr. J, all 16 possible sequences should be equally likely, because each shot is equally likely to be a hit or a miss. So you'd expect about 5 out of 16, or 31.25%, of Dr. J's 4-shot sequences to be good, with 37.5% moderate and 31.25% bad. But if Dr. J sometimes experienced the hot hand, you might expect a higher proportion of good sequences contributed by those games where he just can't seem to miss. The more prone to hot and cold streaks you are, the more you're going to see hit, 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 and miss, 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 and the less you're going to see hit, miss, hit, miss. The significance test asks us to address the following question. If the null hypothesis were correct and there were no hot hand, would we be unlikely to see the results that were actually observed? And the answer turns out to be no. The proportion of good, bad, and moderate sequences in the actual data is just about what chance would predict, any deviation falling well short of the statistically significant. If the present results are surprising, GVT write, it is because of the robustness with which the erroneous belief in the hot hand is held by experienced and knowledgeable observers. And indeed, while their result was quickly taken up as conventional wisdom by psychologists and economists, it has been slow to gain traction in the basketball world. This didn't faze Tversky, who relished a good fight, whatever the outcome. "I've been in 1,000 arguments over this topic," he said. "I've won them all, and I've convinced no one." But GVT, like Skinner before them, have answered only half the question, namely, what if the null hypothesis is true and there is no hot hand? Then, as they demonstrate, the results would look very much like the ones observed in the real data. But what if the null hypothesis is wrong? The hot hand, if it exists, is brief, and the effect, in strictly numerical terms, is small. The worst shooter in the league hits 40% of his shots, and the best hits 60%. That's a big difference in basketball terms, but not so big statistically. What would the shot sequences look like if the hot hand were real? Computer scientists Kevin Korb and Michael Stillwell worked out exactly that in a 2003 paper. They generated simulations with the hot hand built in. The simulated player's shooting percentage leaped up all the way to 90% for 2 10-shot hot intervals over the course of the trial. In more than 3/4 of those simulations, the significance test used by GVT reported that there was no reason to reject the null hypothesis, even though the null hypothesis was completely false. The GVT design was underpowered, destined to report the non-existence of the hot hand, even if the hot hand was real. If you don't like simulations, consider reality. Not all teams are equal when it comes to preventing shots. In the 2012-13 season, the stingy Indiana Pacers allowed opponents to make only 42% of their shots, while 47.6% of shots fell in against the Cleveland Cavaliers. So players really do have hot spells of a rather predictable kind, namely, they're more likely to hit a shot when they're playing the Cavs. But this mild heat, maybe we should call it the warm hand, is something the tests used by Gilovich, Vallone, and Tversky aren't sensitive enough to feel. The right question isn't, do basketball players sometimes temporarily get better or worse at making shots, the kind of yes-no question the significance test addresses. The right question is, how much does their ability vary with time, and to what extent can observers detect in real time whether a player is hot? Here, the answer is surely not as much as people think, and hardly at all. A recent study found that players who make the first of 2 free throws become slightly more likely to make the next one, but there's no convincing evidence supporting the hot hand in real-time gameplay, unless you count the subjective impressions of the players and coaches. The short life of the hot hand, which makes it so hard to disprove, makes it just as hard to reliably detect. Gilovich, Vallone, and Tversky are absolutely correct in their central contention that human beings are quick to perceive patterns where they don't exist and to overestimate their strength where they do. Any regular hoops watcher will routinely see one player or another sink 5 shots in a row. Most of the time, surely, this is due to some combination of indifferent defense, wise shot selection, or, most likely of all, playing good luck, not a sudden burst of basketball transcendence. Which means there's no reason to expect a guy who's just hit 5 in a row to be particularly likely to make the next one. Analyzing the performance of investment advisors presents the same problem. Whether there is such a thing as skill in investing, or whether differences in performance between different funds are wholly due to luck, has been a vexed, murky, unsettled question for years. But if there are investors with a temporary or permanent